Diego.
Corey.
What's up, man?
Here we are again.
Yeah, here we are. Yeah. It's good to see you.
It's really good to see you. I'm glad we're doing this one in person.
Yeah, I know, for real. It's about time. It feels so different, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You can feel the morphogenetic field of
if you want to take it that deep already, that's good.
you know, that's my brand. Yeah. That's my brand. Man, so of course it's great to see you. But I want to dive into this, you know, meditation retreat you went on, because
sure.
you're fresh out of the egg. You're marinating, yeah. And they cracked your egg open and you hatched, and now you're back and your nervous system is all renewed and restored. So yeah, man, how was it?
It was deep. It was really deep. So I just finished coming out of a 45-day silent Vipassana meditation course. I meditate in the Essen Goenka tradition, so it's a rigorous tradition. Like, we're meditating 11 hours a day, and we spent, so it was 45 days. So the first 15 days, we were doing the practice of Anapana, and Anapana is when you're being aware of the natural respiration, and when you do that, it really calms and concentrates the mind. So you have a lot of time to develop concentration. And then we switch over for the last 30 days to practice Vipassana, which is, you know, you observing reality within the framework of the body to gain wisdom. And the combination of the two, the 15 days of settling your mind and then turning that attention to really be able to understand the universe within, it's so powerful. And I'm only 7 days out of the course, I think, about 7 days. And it's been a nice transition. I mean, the course was, I think, probably one of the hardest/deepest courses I've ever been to, just because, it takes a long time. I've been meditating in this tradition for 12 years, and each time I go back, you just go a little deeper. And this time I came across many quite rough areas of my mind. And luckily the practice was strong enough that I was able to face that inner darkness.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I totally love what you're talking about, and you're articulating it really well to being able to, in my experience, as far as going really inward and in deep meditation, being able to ultimately get that access concentration,
yeah,
to where you are, you know, able to consciously direct your inward attention and focus for extended periods of time.
Right.
Being able to, and also for anyone listening, a good way to start building that is by simply closing your eyes and breathing in, breathing out, and observing with your mind, putting your attention on your chest rising and falling. Mm. And the thing I always tell people to start building that muscle is try to do nothing else. You know, you'll have thoughts, you'll have all these, you know, things coming through. Just allow them to flow, but just observe the chest. And whenever your chest rises, think rising. Whenever you breathe out, think falling. In the space in between the breath, think sitting. And just focus on that. And then I like to give a little extra homework for whenever people inevitably think, well, this is easy. The next step in building the access concentration, which I know you'll get this, is as you're observing your breath moving in and out, continue to keep your attention on your chest and your breath moving in and out, but stop trying to control your breath.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see that it's like, oh, wait a second. Whenever I'm not consciously breathing, can I be a passive observer of the automatic functions of my body without investing my control onto that functionality? And that's how you know you've really cultivated this strong sense of internal awareness. And why that's relevant is because you then can, whenever you go to look at your mind and the mental formations that arise in your mind, you want to be able to observe them without trying to grasp them. You want to be able to let them flow through without trying to control them. It's a beautiful practice to try and build that. But anyway, after building that, being able to then, as you said, go and look deeper and deeper and deeper in a rather objective way is incredible, incredible. So whenever you say that you saw some darkness, if you want to talk about it, I'm curious what these rough parts of your mind and what some of these things are that you're discovering in there.
Sure. I think it's really interesting. I love the way you described Anapana. I think there are a lot of different ways to describe it too. The in the technique that I practice, we more so keep our attention on the triangular area of the nose and above the upper lip. And we're, you know, being aware of the breath coming in and going out. And it's, but to a similar result where the mind gets super concentrated after doing that for extended periods of time. Yeah, I think there's just, you know, when you turn that lens inward, you're going to find things you like and things you don't like. And a lot of the things that you'll find inside of yourself are potentialities, right? Potential actions that you may take in the world. And for some reason, so there's this thing in the Buddhist practice, it's called Maranamsati. So it's like being awareness of death.
Mm-hmm.
And what I felt was this like rabid fear of death that was just, it just shocked me, you know, because I had had a number of courses before that. You know, this is the second time I'm doing a 45-day meditation course. And the first 45-day meditation course was, you know, had its challenges, but it was much more tranquil. And I think in this one, it was interesting where I, you know, hit this like deep tranquility. And in, I think it was about like 28 days into it. And then like, woof, all this like deep, almost hellish stuff started roaring up. And I thought, I was first shocked that that was even in there. Because I was like, you know, and this is what I'm saying is like, it's really important to understand that most of us are functioning on this thin layer of the conscious mind, but the subconscious is massive, literally massive, like the entirety of the universe.
It's infinite, yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah.
So when you start exploring what's in there, you know, sometimes you're just shocked. And I was grateful that all this deep stuff came up after years of development. So I was like, okay, this sucks, but I know how to face it. and you know, I'll tell you, when I came out of the course, my wife also did the 45-day course, and she looked at me before I told her anything. She was like, you look great. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow. I was like, I just been through hell. And, but I'm so happy that I went through it, because it was either a hell that you suppress and it's still in you, or one that you walk through and you overcome. So I'm really glad that I was able to, you know, make some progress.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. I mean, I love that you mentioned navigating death in that space, because it really points to, as you said, you know, the texture and the depth of our subconscious is infinite, because the arising information in our mind is cyclical, never stops.
Right, so thought is an infinite space.
Right, yeah. If you look down into it, it's a fountain, it's a geyser that never stops.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can continue looking deeper and deeper and deeper, and I always like to say, until you're ready to stop.
Yeah.
There's no competition, there's nowhere to get to.
Right.
It's until you feel, you know, you are where you need to be. But what you can do, I think, and it's fascinating you mentioned this with death, is that you will discover these foundational like nodes in your subconscious that are directing your conscious life that you're not aware of, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so this one for death, it's like a part of perhaps resting anxiety that you may experience,
yeah,
or some decision-making that is more based on scarcity as opposed to abundance,
yeah,
or whatever it is. It's like, oh, all these things are actually have these roots down into this fear of death, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So on that point, so the thought of the different varieties of death that are possible would arise in my mind, but what I was feeling was fear. And what's fear? It's like either a deep craving to live, or just another form of deep aversion, right? Craving and aversion are essentially the same thing. They're a deep grasping.
Right.
And it was so funny how, you know, because this practice that in the Essen Goenka tradition, it's very focused on your understanding the four foundations of mindfulness through one of them, through the feeling of the body. And I could feel the fear arising and passing in the body. And I'm like, wow, like there's this, I'm literally throwing buckets and buckets of fear are falling out of my subconscious. And the effect of that, you know, I just like, we're here, it's South by Southwest here in Austin. And I did an event yesterday and I'm walking around and I could feel so much less anxiety than in the past.
Yes.
So I'm, you know, I can already see the benefit of the practice. It's like, okay, the Diego that went into the course is very different than Diego that came out. So rather grateful.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And, you know, ultimately it all boils down to looking at that craving or aversion of fear and death ultimately comes down to control.
Mm.
You know, it's like wanting to let the ego control every situation, like cosmically and interpersonally and internally, and being able to confront all of that. And, you know, we all build these systems of trying to control every situation that we're in, of course.
Yeah.
Even whenever we're talking to someone else, your level of vulnerability, mm-hmm. you know, is a level of control. Your level of, like, what you're speaking on and how you're speaking on it is trying to control the situation. And, you know, we do this without realizing it, like control the situation. So we're kind of presenting this version of self and this ecosystem of connection that feels comfortable that, you know, and that's why you can get really powerful whenever someone is aware of that and they're able to open up and actually accept vulnerability and be able to share, you know, and what have you. But anyway, going back to this example, like looking at those things squarely in the face, like those internal fears and whatnot, noticing that it's like you trying to control life in your own life. And then the only thing you can do is accept it.
Yep.
You can just only accept what is.
Mm-hmm.
Accept what is. And then whenever you do that, you go in, like you said, you go talk in front of 2,000 people, like all of that fear is gone because you're through accepting that fear of death, the anxiety that is happening downstream of that no longer exists.
Exactly. I think of control. When you're trying to control reality, you're basically trying to wage war against reality.
Right.
And you're not going to win because reality is literally just a moving river that just always flows forward. It's constantly moving forward, constantly impermanent, always changing. And I think that's one of the points where we struggle the most is like we're in this constant battle against impermanence. And it's hard. Like impermanence is taking away the things we love. It's, you know, allowing difficult situations to arise. But in the inverse, impermanence is also allowing us to learn, allowing us to even have, you know, to have beautiful moments with the people we love, because without impermanence, there would be no universe.
Right.
Only because the universe fluctuates can we exist. And I think it's this interesting dynamic where intellectually we understand that everything changes. But at the subconscious level, we do not want to accept it. Why? Because we haven't spent the time to be able to deeply feel the truth of the universe within our body, to be able to get accustomed to practicing acceptance by feeling it. Because when we look out onto the world, our minds are constantly tricking us into seeing things as static. But when you close your eyes, you start feeling, okay, actually nothing is static.
Mm-hmm.
It's all moving at the mental level, the physical level. It's constantly just like, you're literally this flowing ocean of vibrations, like atomic vibrations. And when you embrace that, when you become more comfortable with that, when you open your eyes, it becomes easier to be like, oh, I'm currently in this situation, or okay, now I'm in another situation, and you're able to accept better.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I love what you're talking about is seeing the true nature of reality.
Yeah.
You know, seeing that the perception of reality is at its core delusion because it's a perception.
Totally.
And recognizing that you're making a perception about all things, even yourself, even your perception of your perception it's heavy, but it's also super liberating.
Yeah.
Because what it does is it creates so much space in your life and so much patience. Because like the idea of getting frustrated, of judging someone, of things not going your way, in quotes, like that all goes out the window.
Yeah.
You know, because you're just like, oh yeah, this is how I am absorbing. Like my nervous system is reading this moment at this moment in time. I like to like think about it like our nervous system are all instruments in a laboratory. And they're all built a little differently. And they're all taking reading of the same slide, but they're all getting different information, right? And that instrument is our conditioning, our past experience, our inherited, you know, genetic, epigenetics, and all that type of stuff. And so we're all experiencing the same reality, objective reality, but we're perceiving it differently. And the more that you realize that, the more, the less invested you become in the story of it. And therefore, yes, the more you can actually experience closer to what is.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Factor. Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Factor is a really smart way to eat, especially if you're low on time. You just pick the style of meal that you want. They send them to you. They do all of the hard work. All you have to do is heat them up in 2 minutes, and you are ready to go. There's no prep, no mess, no cleanup. It's just that simple. They also have a bunch of awesome add-ons like protein shakes, smoothies, wellness shots, and more. You can also save money with Factor. They've done the math, and Factor is less expensive than takeout. And every meal is dietitian approved, so you know you're actually getting nutrition in there, as opposed to takeout. Who knows what you're getting? So to try it out, head over to factormeals.com/hitme50 and use code hitme50 to get 50% off. That's code hitme50 at factormeals.com/hitme50 to get 50% off.
Have you thought about, like, I've been having this experience, and I'm not a physicist at all, but I've like,
oh, don't short yourself. Come on.
Yeah.
Yes, you are.
I've like dabbled in a little bit of, you know, reading about physics, and I keep having this experience where, like, right now when we're interacting within a Newtonian framework.
Yeah.
But when you close your eyes and you start meditating, you start feeling the way reality is genuinely moving, you're like getting closer to like a quantum mechanical framework.
Totally.
And everything's fluctuating. It's been hitting me. It's like, yeah, like everything is in motion. And, you know, whenever I read physics, I wish I knew more, but everything is just like constantly moving. And it's funny to me because that the Buddha, when he became enlightened, he talked about these same things. He was like, you know, he wasn't touching quantum mechanics at the depth that people are touching it at now, but he had a sense that this entirety of this universe is one that's in motion, and that there are, like, you know, he even talked about things that are kind of like subatomic particles mm-hmm. called them kalapas. And I think it's so interesting that the person who liberated their mind and then taught others how to liberate their minds also came out with like a basic understanding of physics.
It's insane. Whenever you go back and read, you know, the original commentaries and things like that, where it's just, he's talking about things that modern science just discovered in the last 100 years. Yeah. And he's basically like, hey, check this out. Here's this idea.
I know. It's totally. And when I think of the Buddha, like, I don't consider myself a Buddhist, but I take the Buddhist teachings super seriously.
Yeah, same here.
And when I think of the Buddha, right, like he was just like the premier psychologist of human history. Mm-hmm. Like he understood the mind far better than anyone else, to the point where he was able to liberate himself from suffering.
Totally.
And I think that's like, to me, it's just shocking that it's even possible. But then he proved the experiment. Then he gave the technique that he used, gave it to a bunch of other people. They were also liberating themselves. And for the past 2,500 years, people have been taking steps forward out of suffering. It's pretty cool.
It's very cool. Yeah. It's like, even when you look at something like the Abhidhamma Pitaka, and it's like, how did, like, no one could write that now.
I know. You know what I mean? I know.
People are still processing it.
Talking about like mind moments and like how many and all of that. Like, I haven't studied the Abhidhamma that deeply, but I've like heard there's this one chanting that we have in the Goenka tradition that is by S.N. Goenka's teacher, Sayadaw Bakhyen. And it's called the Tika Patana. And the Patana is one of the books of the Abhidhamma. The Tika Patana is a commentary on the Abhidhamma, on the Patana, which is one of the books. And whenever we meditate with that chanting, it is explosive, because all that chanting is doing is just describing the finest aspects of reality, like how the universe functions. And it's wild how powerful it is.
I want to get back. I don't want to lose what you're talking about in terms of processing reality with your eyes closed versus your eyes open.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a really good teaching tool. Like, because whenever we're experiencing reality normally, so much of our brain processing and real estate and the like mental real estate and the way that we're associating our experience of reality into thought is dictated by the geometric assimilation and understanding of our three-dimensional reality.
Yep.
And like, this sounds like I'm going into some 432 hertz 5D stuff. I'm not at all. I'm talking about, like, because as conscious agents suspended in meat spacesuits, we are moving through space and time, which is a three-dimensional space, has an X, Y, and Z axis. As being an animal, we need to process where shapes are, where other animals, figures, things, moving things are, to create a sense of depth of field, width of field, and so there that way we can navigate through our three-dimensional world. And that processing, not only does it take a lot of the brain to process that information, but also it is so incredibly abundant with symbolism.
Yeah.
That it makes the mind see so much in terms of the symbols we're applying to, where I'm like, that's a plant. And what's interesting is that I'm like, that's a plant. And then I go, actually, it's a fake plant. You know what I mean?
And you start evaluating.
Yeah. And it's like, that's a camera. That's a Diego, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. This is a me. And, you know, you have to process all that stuff. But with your eyes closed, you're experiencing you're experiencing a sense of consciousness before the symbols and signs are applied to your reality. So you get that upstream version of thinking about reality. And if you really go deeply into that, you ultimately get to the signless version of like non-perception almost with thinking about what you're experiencing. And that truly is the foundation of consciousness, is what's arising in the mind before we apply the symbols of physical reality, also the symbols of, and signs, I guess to use a proper language, the signs of identity even.
Yeah.
The signs that we apply to our thoughts. You know, that's whenever it gets really interesting, is when you're in meditation and you're just observing your mental formations move by on the stage of your mind, and you can like back out of the symbols and signs you're applying to them and just see it as just kind of effervescent sort of like data moving by.
Oh, I love that we're going this deep. So my experience of what you're talking about is that I always felt like, I know there's a trend where it's rather popular to talk about, you know, be the observer, like be consciousness. And this thing that we think of as consciousness is also something that's impermanent. It's also something that's fluctuating. And one of my experiences while meditating is that when I immerse myself so deeply in the feeling of impermanence, it becomes clear sometimes where you're cognizing, and the way they're cognizing will start activating your perception, and your perception will start evaluating whatever it is that you're cognizing. And then that will create sensations on the body, and then you're reacting to those sensations.
Yeah.
And this, like, you know, flow of what the Buddha calls the five aggregates that compose the entirety of the universe. So that's consciousness, perception, sensation, reaction, and matter. And that literally composes the entirety of everything. But what's interesting is that, and you even, like, going back to the Abhidhamma, like, there are works that talk about how there are different modes of consciousness and all these different minds that you can have. And so when you, my example, like, I mean, my, not my example, but my experience is that there actually is no observer, right? It's just, sometimes it feels like there's an observer, but when you allow your awareness to go, to become even stronger, you start seeing that that observer is also composed of component parts that are moving.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's like, it's called like the ego spiral or something like that. I can't recall the guy's name. He's a Western philosopher, but he described it well in that it's like consciousness in terms of what you're talking about is more of like the lens of a camera.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to there being someone looking through the camera. Mm-hmm. So there is an image and information moving through there, but we're not really present to be, it's just the information that's present, not really someone in there watching the information.
Yeah. I think, you know that moment in how that there's that gray moment in the history of like biology on Earth where there were different things being composed, or like, you know, that were moving, and basically that moment before life and after life, like when life began.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me really wonder, like the more I meditate, I'm like, is what happened just greater complexity? And actually, like, and then we just started calling it life, because when I'm examining what's happening inside the framework of the body, there's just movement. It's just speed. Mm-hmm. And it makes the illusion that, oh, Diego's here, Corey's here, Diego and Corey are having a conversation. But it really just feels like rapid movement of complexity. And if I were to really just take my awareness and pierce inward, it's really nothing. It's just something that's fluctuating and very temporary. So sometimes it makes me even wonder. And now I hope, you know, whomever is listening, it's not like in the sense that this is like a negative thing or a scary thing. Like, life is beautiful, right? Life is fantastic. The same way that we're talking about this ultimate level of reality that, you know, I generally, if you ask me, do I exist? No. Fundamentally, no. But I am here. Like, mm-hmm. I'm a person, you know? So there's like the conventional reality or the consensus reality. Like, yes, Diego and Corey are having a conversation, but are we ultimately real? No, both things are true. So these two truths that may seem contradictory, they're not. They're actually, they can sit together side by side. And in those two truths, personally in my life, I have found so much more peace and calmness. It's like open the doors to peace by letting go of my identity and allowing it to just fluctuate, not being so tight that like Diego has to be this and Diego has to accomplish these goals, and instead just letting it flow, letting my preferences fluctuate over time. And of course, I still have my commitments, like, you know, like I love my parents, I love my wife, I love, you know, like making sure that they're safe and sound and caring for them. But at the same time, like, I know that I'm just like, you know, effervescent, like,
yeah. It's like playing, there's the actor in life,
yeah,
and then there's the one writing the script,
yeah,
you know what I mean? And then there's one behind all of that,
mm-hmm.
And then there's nothing behind all of that. Yeah, I totally feel like that's actually one of the big, you know, things for me that I always really like had a sense that that was true, but really I deeply accepted that that was true during COVID. Like whenever there was a lockdown, like I just spent, you know, 2 hours a day in my closet with a door shut and darkness meditating.
Nice. I love a fake cave.
Yeah. modern cave, man.
Yeah.
That was it. That was like, you know, I went back and started rereading the Pali Canon commentaries and just stepping through everything. Because of course, all of the, you know, the modern writing about it, it's all just reframing,
yep,
you know, the original teachings. And so I was like, let me go back. I read all that stuff in my early 20s, but let me go back and read it now and see how it feels. Because I want to really understand it from a fundamental level. And I just kind of like rewalked myself through it all. Yeah. And yeah, that's where I came out, really, not only just having the intellectual idea of that, but really accepting that idea. And right after things started opening up and I went and met with a friend to grab a coffee, he was like, so like, what was the biggest insight you had during this time? I was like, I don't exist. And he was like, oh, okay,
great. Oh, I love that. I love that you're going back and reading those texts too, because I do that as well. It's like, I love things that were either, you know, the text from the Pali Canon or things by monks that were sort of reiterating and explaining the Pali Canon. But these are like readings that open up the more you meditate, even like the basic one, like the Dhammapada. I remember I read the Dhammapada. I had only meditated like maybe done like 2 or 3 10-day courses. And I was like, this sucks. This book's no good. And I read it like 3 years later after way more meditation experience. And I was like, oh my goodness, this thing is fire.
Yeah.
You know? And it makes no sense without the context of experience, because it's meant to be like an exploratory like support. And that, you know, that's a lot of what the Pali Canon is as well. But it's so powerful. So I try to go back and read things and I'm like, whoa, now it makes me a little more sense.
Yeah, we're both Analayu Biko boys. Like, you're the only person I know. Whenever he has a new book drops,
I know. As soon as you said
text,
sign list.
Yeah. I just text. Yeah. I just, I'm the only person I know to text. I'm like, dude, did you see the new one came out?
Yeah. I had it on my desk. I remember when you texted me, I was like, yep, I already, you know, that book was so heavy hitting that I had to like read 15 pages and I had to put it down and was like, wow.
Nice.
So I'm gonna pick it up again because I was reading it before the course. But yeah, Bhikkhu Nalaya was just such an amazing person. I was fortunate enough to, he's a monk, and I was fortunate enough to, myself, my wife, and two other friends, we were able to give him part of his morning meal, and we got to hang out with him for about an hour. He was so inspiring and wildly clear. Like, you look in his eyes, and I'm like, there's like not really a sense of self in there. It's mm-hmm. just Dhamma and compassion. So it was very cool meeting him.
Amazing. Yeah, I think like it could be useful if you can, if you framed up these, what you're talking about earlier in terms of having no self, not feeling like you exist. I feel like that may need a little bit more structure, I think, for people to understand, because yeah. it, one of the things I'm cautious of is people hearing that and then it, the very delicious path of nihilism or something like that.
It's so seductive.
Which is, yeah, which is ultimately a desire to not have to be responsible. That's ultimately yeah. what that is.
Wow.
It, you know, it's an excuse to be able to go yeah. towards that and validate a lack of responsibility.
Yeah, so
if you could talk more about it, yeah.
Totally. I think, so my experience of having this deeper understanding of not self, of anatta, which is one of the three characteristics of the universe, is that when you start letting go of that sense of self and you start really feeling that what you're comprised of is motion, it allows what's called the Brahmaviharas to really come to the forefront. So even though I may not be real, it serves me and the environment around me to move through love, compassion, and goodwill. And I think that's very sort of like counter to nihilism, because I think with nihilistic ideals, you can kind of just lose morality and it just becomes utter chaos.
Mm-hmm.
But in this regard, when your sense of self decreases and your equanimity increases, it allows for this loving kindness to really flourish and come to the forefront, where it makes it much easier to maintain the precepts. And you're like, of course, you know, I don't want to kill anybody. I don't want to lie. I don't want to, you know, deceive anyone. I don't want to steal from anyone. I want to just live in a way where I'm trying to create harmony within myself and share that harmony with others. And I think that quality, like, and I have a ways to go in developing that quality. Don't get me wrong. I'm not like perfect or enlightened or anything like that. Just another person that's on the path. But the development of those qualities of loving kindness, they have grown. I can feel them growing as my ego is shrinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. And I think that for me, how I think about it is like, just because I say I feel no sense of self doesn't mean there's no like Corey. What it means in the most condensed reduction sauce is that I understand and accept that my perception of who I am and what I'm experiencing is always changing.
Yeah.
And I'm not attached to a solid version of who I am. So yes, I'm here, but I'm always changing and I'm not grasping it at all.
Yeah.
And that leads to just naturally what you were talking about is integrity and wholesomeness and, you know, compassion, equanimity, because you understand that everyone else is experiencing the same thing.
Yeah.
They might not realize it, you know, but once you see it in yourself, you then see whenever someone else is frustrated, you're not like, oh, they're being frustrated at me.
Yeah.
Their anger is an inconvenience to my ego.
Yeah.
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 It's like, no, there's also a person who is in the midst of, you know, endless change, who is momentarily grasping something that is causing them suffering.
Yeah.
So I can be present with them while that's happening, and not, my ego doesn't feel either like it's not getting the attention or the space or whatever story you're telling yourself to feel represented in that moment, you know. And it just really is a beautiful, gives you a beautiful ability to have an endless sense of presence and openness. And really, I think to me, a powerful thing is the non-judgment aspect of it.
Yeah.
Because whenever you can, and this is something I notice, because I'm always watching my own mind, and I'm watching how the person I'm engaging with's mind, and I'm watching how our minds are interacting. And the more that in my life I was able to just really truly let go of judgment, the more that I notice that other people instantly feel comfortable with me.
Yeah.
Like the second we sit down, they're just like, oh, cool. Like, I've known this guy forever. And it's like, it's because I just, you know, you can feel what people are bringing to the table. And so being able to bring that openness gives other people the comfort to be open in ways they might not be able to in their life in other places. And it's just like, it's a beautiful type of connection.
Yeah, I love that. I'm glad that you're steering the conversation in a direction that is grounded in the consensus reality. Because I think this is sometimes, you know, I think in previous podcasts, I'm allowing myself to let loose because I know you have so much meditation experience as well. So, but usually I don't like talk about what happens in my own meditation, because it's like, it's a gray area. Like, how can you really like understand, you know, like another person who may have not gone through certain retreats, and people are also meditating very different techniques.
Totally.
So it's all kind of like fuzzy. And especially when you're translating these like clear experiences into words, you're losing a lot.
Yes.
Because like word is just like not as good as direct experience.
Yeah.
But it's funny when listening to you talk, and when we're talking about this quality of not self, it personally has made me realize that like I'm just here to meditate and chill. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm totally not interested in harming anybody. And in fact, I am interested in helping. But it's like it's become that simple life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I'm here to meditate and chill, and I am interested in harming people. That's the difference between us. No, that's, you know, I actually made, I think this can be useful for people too, speaking on like going inward and kind of understanding those deeper things about themselves, is I actually, whenever I reached kind of some of those areas of self-understanding and acceptance that we were talking about, I actually made an agreement with myself.
Yeah.
Where I was like, I get this, and from this moment forward, I will never not be in integrity. Mm. I'll always just do right and do the right thing. It sounds like so simple, but it's like, just do the right thing.
Yeah.
And you may feel resistance against it. And it could be a little thing. It could be a big thing.
Yeah.
But whatever it is, just all, because you know, you can feel it, tension of like, oh, I don't want to do this because I'm resisting it, but I know what's right. Just recognizing that and be like, I will just always do right.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that quality, I think it was the monk Webu Sayadaw, who's a Burmese monk. I think he passed away in the 70s. He's fully liberated, and he fully understood the quality of not self, like unlike us, we're like gradually understanding it. He talked about the five precepts as being like a shield, being protective. And I think it's really true. Like this, what you were talking about, this feeling of like, I'm trying to do what's right. You know, I'm not trying to hurt anybody, not trying to hurt myself. And in that quality, you find that life becomes a lot smoother, because there are less things that you regret that you did. And less people are mad at you, because at the end of the day, you can't control how people perceive you.
Sure.
You may come to them with the most gentlest, loving action, and they, for some reason, might be triggered in some manner, and they might not like you. That's fine. But at your core, you're actively not trying to hurt anybody, and you're also refining your actions so that they become clearer and clearer. And I think as I've been living my life, you know, upholding the five precepts. And so the five precepts are no killing, no stealing, no lying, no sexual misconduct or sex outside of like a partnership, and no intoxicants. And I took up that code and been living by it, I think almost like 8 or 9 years now. And it's made life way better.
Yeah.
Way, 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 way better. Just simplified everything.
When you stopped all the killing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Things are just
probably in my past lives as a warlord.
Yeah.
I'll be in the meditation cell and I think, I'm like, never again will I be part of an army or anything like that. Like, I forevermore am standing on the side of do not kill.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, because those five precepts, man, I know you used to kill people, steal the body, and then lie about it all the time. So, yeah, it's good that you stopped that, man. Yeah. It does, and it makes life a lot smoother.
Yeah.
You know, where you don't have to do those things anymore. Yeah. I mean, I know you're talking about going deep into some of the intricacies of your own experience. Like, I do think that stuff is super valuable because it does lay out, you know, some roadmap and some sort of exploratory thinking for people.
Yeah.
That even if they hear about it now and it sort of sounds like white noise to them.
Yeah.
Like later, years later, they might, something might click. So it's really valuable. But yeah, I always do think it's super valuable to then ground that stuff in something that people maybe can take forward. Yeah.
With them. So what traditions, like was, are you, did you learn from Mahasi or where did you pick up your techniques?
Man, I am just a total autodidact with everything.
Yeah.
Barely graduated high school.
Yeah.
And just basically am self-taught. I've never had a teacher.
You were a monk in a past life?
Exactly.
I mean, you look like a monk.
Yeah. I was a drunk monk in the past life. I'm totally self-taught. It's all basically been woodshedding my entire life.
And you haven't had have you gone to retreats? Like you haven't gone to the Tathagata Center or anything?
I've just created my own retreats.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Just
awesome.
Always a solo practitioner.
You're going to be like a Pacheco Buddha at some point. Yeah. Like that. You're just in the age of darkness, it'll just arise and know how to turn the wheel of Dhamma.
Yeah, right. Right. I mean, that's what, from an early age, like I've been meditating for 25 years, and at the very beginning, for some reason, and I say for some reason as to make it clear that I don't think I had a hand in it. It was a coalescing of causality.
Yeah.
That's the name of my concept album.
Yeah.
Coalescing of causality. Gonna have three orchestras, man, playing different scores all at once. it was like, it was clear to me that it's all about watching your mind.
Yeah.
And I thought, if I just watch my mind, as long as I watch my mind, I'll never be without a teacher because the mind is the teacher that you need. All you have to do is watch it with enough clarity and you can learn everything that you need to know by that. And when I say that, that means that you watch your desires, you watch your anger, you watch your reactions, you watch how you are putting together a story that's serving whatever it is that you want to be telling yourself about reality and yourself in this moment in time. And although doing that is a painful, long process, I just knew it would lead to clarity, and it did. So that brings up something kind of funny and fun that I wanted to mention to you, is that as you were doing your 45-day retreat, it actually, because you told me you were going to do it before you did it,
I talked to you like 2 days before.
Yeah. I was during the middle of it, I was like, oh yeah, he's still on the retreat. And I thought, let me do an unretreat and just see what happens. So because I've been meditating every day for more than half my life now, I was like, what if I stop meditating for like 2 weeks or something and just keep watching my mind and just see what happens.
How was the buildup of formations?
It's been, and I think I've had so much kind of runway of doing it to where it slowly started creeping in, but I started watching it and it's like, the tension in the body.
You gotta cut the grass.
Yeah. Tension in the body arising, the fidgetiness of mind, the absorption towards distraction, you know, the craving for all this. So it was really interesting to watch just sort of the calcification start to get on the steel again.
Oh my God, I will not join you on that adventure. I've been meditating every day for, I don't know, I suck at keeping count, like maybe like 9 years or something. I started 12 years ago. Yeah, 9 years. I've been meditating 2 hours a day. And I really feel that because this is like a process where you're trying to pull out the roots of craving aversion so that they don't keep growing. But it's a long path. It's very gradual, right? You keep building up and eventually you will be successful in ending suffering. But on the root there, you got to cut the grass because the grass will grow back if you don't cut it.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I mean, I think that it's a fun experience because the reason why I did it was because I'll be talking to people And even though I don't really talk about meditation that much, people talk to me about it all the time. People bring it up to me. And
You and I are like the meditation guys.
Which I don't think of myself as that, but everyone else does.
Yeah.
Which maybe it's a good, maybe that's a good position to be in, internally, I mean. What I try and do whenever talking about anything, really, I think about like the curse of knowledge. Like, you're so familiar with ideas, you're so familiar with process and like lived experience, that I'll be like, how does this sound to someone who's never experienced, they've even tried to meditate before? Like, what I'm saying, like, what does it even sound like to them? So I try and go back to like kind of original mind of like, what was my perception like before I started meditating, so I can understand what I'm saying now and connect it with someone who has no experience more clearly. And so that was why I did this non-meditation retreat, because I was like, let me try and get some formations on there, and just so I can experience what it's like, so that then I can easily, of course, you know, release them. But now I'll have just a different context to be able to talk about them.
Yeah, that's really cool. And were you like, how was it when you started meditating again? Was your mind nice and chunky?
Yeah, it was a little chunky. Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah, it was interesting. We only have a few minutes left, but I want to try and open up a really complicated topic real quick and see how quickly we can move through it.
Yeah.
So whenever you talk about being in your meditation retreat and looking inward, and you mentioned craving and attachment and things like that a lot, something that I experience, you talk about energy, it's just such a ripe area that I have a hard time talking to other people about, because they don't, I can't really, we can't find conversational ground about it. I don't know people that can. So, as I moved really deeply into looking into like the three poisons, you know, of anger, desire, and delusion, I started like really removing the signs and the symbols from them and just paying attention to what they are in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, what I got down to is like, oh, there, it's just arising energy. It's just like, you're like a tuning fork, and it's just the vibration of those things arising in your nervous system on a physical reaction in relationship to your response to your experience or your perceived experience.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that in two minutes?
You're hitting at like the final points, right? So like this field of Vedana, this field of sensation where everything is arising and passing, it's a field that's ultimately a field of suffering. And even though in this field there are things like love, compassion, these sort of beautiful qualities that are available within this universe, those qualities are still subject to impermanence. So sometimes we become very attached to love and compassion, and then they're, you know, they end at some point. And this giant field of movement, of arising energy, like you're describing it, it's still something that's subject to decay. And it, to me, when I get deep like that in the meditation, it points to the truth that there's something outside of the universe. And it points to the potential of nibbana. Nibbana being the space where, I mean, you can't even describe it, right? It's something that you describe something that you experience that's beyond description. And it points to the fact that there in nibbana, there is, quote unquote, this profound, peaceful stillness that is not really quite available in this universe that is one of movement. And it, I think it's rather interesting. And, you know, it makes me think about my whole meditation experience as like, I'm just like an astronaut. I'm literally just exploring the universe inside the framework of the body, studying it and understanding that, like, yeah, this giant field of fluctuation of ever, you know, of constant impermanence, it's beautiful in the sense that I'm learning from it, but ultimately it's one of suffering, because like all the beautiful things end. And because of attachment, because the mind is geared towards attachment, it hurts when they end. And we can work on releasing those attachments, but when you deeply work on releasing all attachments, the mind becomes powerful enough, subtle enough, it can accept so deeply that it actually goes beyond the universe and attains the truth of nibbana.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you mentioned being an astronaut, you know.
Yeah.
Turns out future is like the Zen master. It's like Pluto. but yes, what you're saying, and this, you know, brings up an interesting thought to me that like the notion of Nibbana, shout out to the Theravadan spelling.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I'm like one of the only cats that's talking in
I'm
Pali.
All bees, man. Yeah. Same here. Yeah. Same here. This level of, as you said, like it's stillness, you mm-hmm. know, it's a conscious experience, without agitation. And if we rewind back up into our earlier description of conscious experience and looking inward and it being based in physicality and the arising of the body and the mind, that movement is agitation. You know, and when exactly. you look at like the pearl in the clamshell, it's like, well, it's created through agitation.
Yep.
And that's why lowering the, I hate to use the word vibration, you know, or frequency mm-hmm. of mind, the, let's call the tempo of being mm-hmm. internal and external, you get closer to that feeling of peaceful, abundant presence. Yeah. And you get this, you get the scent of enlightenment of what it right. might be like.
Getting in proximity of Nibbana.
Yeah.
There's this thing that happens when, you know, like in these long meditation courses where your mind becomes so, for lack of a better word, becomes quite powerful. Mm-hmm. Like what your mind is able to do in those courses, like it's not like anything supernatural, but it's just like, it has wild amounts of focus. It is so clear. So able to perceive reality as it is, which is such a rare quality, but the mind becomes so clear and it starts becoming so straight that even the breath becomes something that feels like a form of agitation, mm-hmm. where like the breath starts feeling clunky. And even though you're, you know, when you're in deep meditation like that, you've been meditating for a bunch of hours a day, you're breathing so lightly, so delicately, and it's a very, you know, you're not thinking about your breath, but even those tiny little breaths feel clunky and you're like, oh, it's getting in the way of me observing reality clearly. But there's something interesting about how when you start following the Buddhist teaching, the purpose of them is to show you that there is suffering, and you don't have to use the word suffering. You can use the word dissatisfaction, stress, tension, that life is, you know, life has a lot of stress. You can definitely mm-hmm. agree with that. But then there's a way out of stress. There's a way out of dissatisfaction. There's a way out of suffering. And it's quite powerful just seeing how all of these tiny reverberations in this universe, whether it's like a sensation in the body or the breath, it's a little bit of agitation in them. There's tiny little bits of, mm-hmm. of suffering. And at some point, the mind will just go beyond that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Diego, thank you, man. This has been great.
Yeah.
It's been so fun. It's been great to be able to do this in person. And I'm looking forward to us doing it again sometime, but doing like the 3-hour version.
Yeah, whenever. I didn't know we were going to go heavy into the Dhamma, but I'm loving it. We can only do this with such few people. So I'm glad that we were able to rap about that.
Yeah, me too, man.